You're listening to the Slavic Literature Pod, your shelf help guide to all things Slavic. I'm Cameron Lalana.
And I'm Matt Garasimovich.
And today we're covering part two, chapter 43 of Vasily Grossman's Life and Fate, moving on up the chain of command at the gas chamber as we follow now the a commander whose title I've tried to pronounce in the past and it's not gone well, so I'm just going to call him Officer Kaltluft, who is in charge of everything. He's the director of this. He makes sure that everything goes according to plan, and he does that very well because he is a fastidious worker. All the other officers are willing to get drunk and have fun. He merely wants to go back home to his farm and just organize things, and so he puts that energy into making sure everything is in place to make the gas chambers run. And most of this chapter is actually not concerned with that, but rather with the question of who could judge Kaltluft or people like him. And is there anywhere here that you'd like to start?
Yeah, I kind of wanted to start on not even the judgment question, but just the question of who he is. And what I found most striking about this chapter is the way in which he is described in terms that that we would probably consider positively today. Like, he is the absolute encapsulation of that grind set hustle culture. Like if this guy had TikTok, like, he would be insufferable. And that, like, that same mentality is so pervasive, and it was so reminiscent of our conversation that we had with Maya Vinokur on optimization and lifestyle fascism. And in this case, it is literal lifestyle fascism. It's just not exactly what we were talking about, but there were some overlaps for me there. And when I was talking either last chapter or a few chapters ago on that sort of idea that this idea of just sort of completely missing the point, I think this chapter does a good job of that, because yes, sure, he's a very hard worker and, you know, does this and that right in the eyes of his boss or whoever, but it misses the point. He's doing something awful. And I think that's something that we miss today. I mean, we're not, many of us aren't doing things that are, you know, on this level, but, you know, oftentimes there are things we could be doing better. And I think that to shuffle the responsibility off onto, you know, I don't want to become like a personal responsibility guy. You know, I'm not going to say make your bed and it'll all be okay. There is of course some degree of personal responsibility, I think, that Grossman kind of foisted upon us in this chapter.
Yeah, definitely.
Make your bed.
Grossman said make your bed and lie in it.
yeah, literally.
I want to go here to a thought from Dominique, who today posted in verse, "Let he who is without sin cast the first stone." And then going on to say, tough chapter, but another good reminder that few resist, but some do. Or maybe it's getting at how few people can completely resist in regards to the totalitarian state. I'm sure there were those who weren't holy fools that did small acts of resistance in reference to Konnikov. It seems Grossman is critiquing people who don't resist, but not quite condemning. And yeah, I think that that's, we've been, it's like, as you say about this question of personal responsibility, it may be, I think, easy to say, and this chapter suggests that it would be very easy to say that on this theoretical day of judgment, or on the, I guess, pretty actual Nuremberg trials, you know, this person could say, no, look, I didn't want to do this. I just wanted to do a simple job at home, but it was the war. The party was really adamant on this thing. I mean, this is what people wanted. It was just my job. How could I have gone against that? I am one small individual person. How could I go against the will of this state? I didn't choose this. I was pushed towards it. And then the narrator gives us this sort of theoretical sinner and says, the sinner can measure the power of the totalitarian state and find it limitless through propaganda, hunger, loneliness, infamy, obscurity, labor camps, and the threat of death. This terrible power can fetter a man's will. But the narrator still asserts that while a man may be led by fate, he can still refuse to follow. It asserts that regardless of the power, you are still choosing to do these things. That it is not so much that, well, you've got no choice but to resist, but rather that each individual person understands what they stand to gain or stand to lose by going along with these wills. And I think that's why, Dominique makes an apt point here that it seems that Grissom is critiquing, but not quite condemning, because the sinner too, this person who understands the power, is also someone who has made those same compromises. But in talking about this question of judgment, the narrator kind of says, you know, it really won't be a celestial judge, a perfect, you know, citizen who makes the judgment of a sinner such as this Kaltluft, who has made these decisions in the context of the fascist state, of the all-powerful state. It will be another sinner who has made the same decisions as him and understands better than any of the others what compels someone to make that decision. And therefore, perhaps, this is sort of my reading it, this gives them the moral authority to still judge, because if you've never been in that situation, you can't understand the power it has over you. But if you have been in that situation, you understand that you still have the power to make your own decisions. And it is ultimately your choice to make the ones to say, in Kaltluft's case, murder almost 600,000 people.
Yeah, and I do think, to your point, that it does have a sort of almost lawyerly quality here in the fact that the narrator specifically quotes or says 590,000 people. I don't know that we've necessarily had a real clear-cut number at any point in the book. I know Grossman does kind of go through the mass scale, but I'm not sure that we've had a real concrete number assigned to a specific person. And so that is a clear, assigning of, well, I don't know, not necessarily guilt, but responsibility for sure. And I think that he, I don't know, I think that when he gives that number in the context of the argument that is normally made, well, how could I, you know, one person resist? It sort of almost puts the question on the inverse, which is how could you, one person, really, you know, like how could you stand to see that and help do that? It's almost unbelievable. And I think the way that he poses it is more disgusting, really, in that you're not forced into doing it. You're really incentivized into doing it, which is dirtier to me. You know, it's one thing if you're sitting there with a gun to your head saying, do this, do that, okay? But when you're just promised certain privileges that other people don't have, that's, you know, a little nasty, to say the least.
Right. Yeah. At the same time, though, I think there is a moral equivalency being drawn across all these previous chapters, from Rosa to the prisoners to Kaltluft, either from, you know, the gun to the head or from this. But I think you're correct too that there is something kind of specific about Kaltluft, and maybe Rosa too falls in this category, where it is not just like a question of how much should I do to survive, but separately, what am I willing to do to maintain a comfortable life?
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that's why the sinner, another person who has made these compromises, is best able, in a way that people who can't, you know, or haven't been in that situation, can't quite judge. And when I say, I mean, of course, someone who hasn't been in that situation can judge, but they maybe don't have the same nuance or understanding of just how, like you say, disgusting it might be, as someone who has been in that situation knows that, no, I know that you can, you can choose otherwise. I did. And I think maybe this is something I read, and this is something, it's pure conjecture on my part, but an interesting one to read from Grossman's perspective specifically, who is someone who did have a pretty good track record of resistance to the Soviet state on a lot of levels. Not so much that he was in a dissident way, but that he, you know, when his wife was arrested during the purges, he sends a letter to Nikolai Yezhov, the head of the NKVD, saying, hey, here's a legal case for why you should let her go. And, you know, hard to say whether that actually led to her being let go or not, but she certainly was let go. But also someone who later on, when put under pressure, granted pressure that was a surprise meeting on him, to sign the letter of the to condemn the so-called doctors of the so-called doctor plot, right? He too had made these compromises, but he also within that society push back, and maybe having made that knows better than anyone the power you do have to not carry out that decision, even though you may sometimes.
Yeah, it's complex, but I think it does. It's even more interesting coming from Grossman.
Yeah, I think that's all I had to cover today, unless there's anything else you wanted to talk about.
No, that's all I had on this one, I think. So in that case, I think you will be hearing from us again soon.